Well, today's episode, we're going back into someone who's had a sporting background in the NBA, but mostly he is known as an organizational psychologist. He's also a chartered scientist on the Science Council and a chartered fellow. He's also a non-exec director of the Manchester NHS Trust. This guy has so many strings to his bow, and I think you're going to absolutely love this today. So I hope you enjoy it. Hi, everyone, and welcome back or welcome to The Psychology of Success. I'm Paul McVeigh. And when I started this podcast, I wanted to speak with people who could share their insights and expertise that wasn't easily accessible. Or if it was accessible, then it would come at a high price to sit and listen to someone with their experience, which is why I'm delighted to introduce my guest today, who is an organizational psychologist. He is a New York Times best-selling author and founder of APS Intelligence. So John Amici, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
John, really, really good to have you today. I have so many things I want to cover with you, and I don't think we're going to be able to squeeze them in 60 minutes, but do you want to kick off the way we kick off the show every single time? And the first question is, what is the definition of success?
Success is supposed to be, I think, personally defined. It's supposed to be purposeful, meaningful, individually so. It's not supposed to be comparative, I don't think. Success is supposed to be, to me, an indication of the distance traveled, not the heights achieved. Because some people start halfway up the mountain and others have to cross the sea to get to the base of the mountain. And so comparing two people on the outcome at the end is often a distortion of the truth of achievement.
Yeah, fantastic. Great starting point. And, you know, I think there's so many connotations and probably follow-up questions to your answer there. And I suppose what I'd love to do today, John, is really just to go through some of the, you know, incredible achievements you've had throughout your life so far, and really just try and unpick them and try and understand a bit more about you, a bit more about why you did it, how you did it, why people like you who had similar opportunities or similar, you know, strengths didn't go on and do it. So maybe just as a starting point, could you maybe give us a bit of an understanding of kind of where it kind of started for you and what your life was like as you were growing up?
So I grew up in Stockport, north of England, near Manchester. My mum was a GP, single parent family, never felt wanting because of it. Two sisters, definitely grew up with pretty much everybody in an academic sense underestimating my capabilities. I went to a school that streamed students, and I was devastated when I was streamed into the third stream, not the first two, which were the clever streams, but the third stream. I was devastated. And I've spent my time, I suppose, trying to prove people wrong. I'm quite contrasuggestive. I love to prove people wrong. I started off with the intention of becoming a psychologist when I was about 7 years old. That was always my goal. I don't know that I could have envisioned psychology as we now experience it as psychologists. Psychology is this bigger space now, I think, where lots of different types of people can employ psychology in lots of different ways. So I perhaps had a more kind of counseling approach to it when I was younger. But this was the goal. I got sidetracked by sport, but not because of sport itself. I could give a damn about sport then and now. But what I do know is that through basketball in particular, I met a group of people who saw my potential, who saw what I was capable of, perhaps even beyond what I thought I was capable of, and helped me pursue that. And that's what kept me in sport. It was just such a lovely environment. Sport at its best, right? That lovely environment that supports you to challenge yourself, that challenges you when you fail to, and supports you when you fail to as well. So that's my journey to sport, to psychology. I ended up in the NBA as well as playing in Europe. And none of that is, you know, I don't know if I have any like major pivotal memories from that that say, yes, that's the thing, other than walking onto a court for the first time and realizing I'd done it, what I'd set out today, this improbable, unlikely thing.
Because out of all of those, you know, achievements that you're talking about, and again, you know, we'll probably discuss some more than others today, but the first thing that really sticks out for me there, Jonathan, you wanted to be a psychologist at 7.
It's true, but I have an advantage. I come from a very weird family, and now I'm part of a weird, wonderful company. So when I was younger, my mother and I would read biology books together. It was a subject I didn't enjoy and struggled with, and so we'd read about mitochondria together. When I was younger, I read Asimov at 7, and my mother encouraged me to read science fiction and science and to really invest in learning and words. She knew how important it would be for me to be able to speak, to project the contents of my brain on the world in a way that influenced and kept me safe. So when I, you know, when I watched her operate as a doctor, as a GP, the thing that I noticed above all things was not the medicine bits that I never got to witness when I went on visits with her and I got to watch how she interacted with family members, but never how she interacted with patients. Because I knew that I'm not a blood and guts person. I can't do, needles are fine, as in me getting an injection, but I could never give anybody else one. But I watched how she interacted with the families of patients and how her presence, her purposeful presence, helped them to cope, to manage, to feel like they could carry on just another week. And I thought that was the magic bit of her job. And if I could avoid the other bit of her job, that would be perfect. And so as far as I was concerned, psychology was the ideal job that meant I could still help people to feel better without ever having to cut a cadaver.
Yeah. And for anyone who's going live and watching us live today, you'll see your book that's just coming out, The Promises of Giants, in your background. And of course, if you're listening to this as a podcast later on, you won't be able to see that. So I do want to come to the book a little bit later. But, you know, you were very kind to share your book with me. And I just want to take one of the questions that your mum asked you. I think it was whenever you're having the conversation about where you were going to go potentially for university. And she said, would you recognize your soul in the dark? And can you give us a little bit around that whole story? Because I feel that's such a powerful question and message to ask a young John.
This is an example of how weird my family is, right? That's a weird question for most families. We are atheists, and so it's even weirder when you consider the kind of language of it in that context. The idea of seeing your soul in the dark is the idea that my mother told me that most people, they spend their entire life wondering what they're going to do, and because of that they forget to ask who they want to become, who they want to be. And so you can end up going through your entire life moving from one job to the other, doing things, that thing that we do where we talk about what we do, not who we are. And they spend their entire life navigating this complex array of structures in workplaces and never consider what it is that drives them, what it is that's meaningful to them, what it is that's purposeful. They never understand the bits about themselves that are truly brilliant and the bits about themselves that are less attractive, less positive, perhaps internal sabotaging elements of yourself. And so my mother encouraged me to understand that if I wanted to do something extraordinary, something that other people did not do, and indeed at the time had never been done, getting to the MBA, getting a career in the MBA as a British person, then I needed to know myself better. You know, one of the first revelations I had when I went through this process with my mother to see my soul in the dark was to realize that I'm incredibly lazy. Incredibly lazy. And that was a brilliant and really useful piece of information for my success, because it means that my life consists of constantly building structures to stop me from being as lazy as I want to be. Right now, my entire life exists in my diary. I'm not going to show you, it's got client names on it, but it's right there. And it's packed from 6:30 in the morning till around 8 o'clock at night. My life runs on that schedule, and that means I know when work finishes and when I can crash or recuperate. And that's helped me throughout my entire career. The fact, just the knowledge, the really clear insight that if given a chance to do the lazy thing, this guy will do it. has meant that I've been able to create structures that stop me, which means I've achieved more than I ever could had I, as so many of us do, ignored the negative stuff about me. It's by no means the only negative thing, by the way, Paul.
But this is interesting, John, because, you know, the identity that, you know, I would have had when I was playing professional football, a lot of it was around the sport. But I think as I started to go through my 20s, I really understood I needed to move more away from the sport side and have more aspects of my identity. But I think you touched on it, that most people would identify as either, you know, the job that they have or the family or the role position within the family. So it's so, what's the word, you know, sweeps across society. So it's really difficult to go against that.
You're right, Paul. It is incredibly difficult to go against it. But I think it's essential for people who really want to achieve because, you know, again, most of the wisdom I have is donated from my mother and other smart people. But I don't think there's anything more dangerous than being what you do. You are not what you do. And being what you do is very dangerous because it means when you stop doing what you do, you also stop being who you thought you were. Nowhere is this more dangerous than in sports, where for almost, especially if you look at the American system, I know little about football in this country, but in the American system, a child can be kind of decided that they're a future prospect in a given sport, baseball, football, basketball, whatever it is, by the time they're 6 or 7. And so from the age of 6 or 7, people will treat them like they are their job. They are going to be a basketball player. They're a basketball player. And then suddenly, even if you're fully successful, your career could be over by the time you're 28, certainly by the time you're 30, and then it stops. And even if you've saved judiciously, even if you've carved out a life for yourself and investments and you don't need to work more, you suddenly end your career and you stop being who you were. And now you have to spend an entire period in limbo or spend a really difficult period figuring out who the hell you are after for most of your life never considering it. I think it's really dangerous. And frankly, it doesn't matter if you're an accountant or you're a basketball player. You are not what you do. You are more than that. Different than that, better than that.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
John, I want to talk about, because you said about, you know, the conversation you're having with your mum. Essentially, for me, reading it in your book, when you decided you wanted to go to America and follow your dream of being the first Briton to play in the NBA. But of course, that had never been done before. So how did you end up in America?
I love this. I love the path that this took. I didn't at the time, but I love it now because it's a good story for illustrating that most of success is in the mundanity. Most of success is in the utterly boring bits that nobody thinks about, nobody cares about, and most people never witness. And certainly you get no credit for it. So I decided I would go to America, and my mum took me to London to an American organization. I think it's the Fulbright Commission. I always say it was, and I'm never quite sure, but I know the book came from the Fulbright Commission. And they had a book full of high schools listed, high schools and universities and everything else. And I knew I couldn't go straight to university because I knew I was terrible at basketball. I was truly bad when I first started. And so that was the way I was going to go. I was going to go to high school for 1 year. So I simply went through this book, not knowing the difference between Arizona or Virginia or anywhere else. I just went through the book state by state, putting a pin in a page and saying, yep, that one. It's how I ended up in Virginia to writing to a school in Roanoke, Virginia, randomly. And then another one, Ohio, another one, somewhere else. And I sent off 3,000 letters. And not forgetting this was back in the day, in the 80s, before email. So I sent off 3,000 letters, essentially saying the same thing, handwritten. Dear coach, my name's John Amici. I'm black, British, and 6'9", maybe 6'8" at the time. I want to play in the NBA. Can I play on your team? That was and the thing is, I was so wonderfully naive that I thought tall people were rare because I didn't meet very many even in basketball circles in Britain as tall as me. And so I thought we were rare, like unicorns. And so I thought when I sent this email, they'd be like, yes, we'll have you. And that's not what happened. Out of 3,000 emails, I got three replies. Two of them were no's. One of them was a very rude no from a very well-known high school in America. It was really fascinating and a lesson in both the arduous mundanity required for success and the resilience against failure and refusal that's required.
And I think whenever you're talking about the lengths, the ridiculous lengths that you have gone to create an opportunity, you're probably already getting rid of the 99% of your competition who would just never do that. But of course, it clearly worked. You had that opportunity, even just fast forward and the fact that you were playing in the NBA and just something I want to pick up on another point, because there were so many little nuggets in your book. And you talk about nice guys don't finish last. And it's something that really resonated with me, because all the way going through my playing days, or even through my 20s, that's maybe because I look like a 12-year-old the whole time, maybe a little bit older now, but everyone thought I was so nice and I hated it, John. I hated it.
No one's ever accused me of being nice. So there's two things. One on the kind of relentlessness of the mundanity. You're right. It does filter out people who aren't willing to do it. This is the amazing part. Even back then, back in the 80s, up to this day, I can guarantee you I am in the maybe 50th percentile of athletes in a basketball sense who are currently playing basketball. Quite literally, the difference between me as an NBA player and most of the peers that I had in basketball at that time was all stuff that could be learned. It was all stuff that could be achieved through planning and graft. And if had anyone else attempted this, they would have eclipsed me in a heartbeat. Because, outside of being an incredibly average NBA player in the scheme of things, the number of brilliant athletes in this country is remarkable. So just amazing to think, right, that as you pointed out, that if you're willing to do the really mundane stuff, to sacrifice in ways that bring no immediate glory, you can achieve more simply because others will fall away. It's fascinating. It's fascinating to me, that part of it especially. I've forgotten the second part because
And
I
it was
went on too
really
long.
no, but it does. I think you're talking about really about how if you can do what others won't, then you get the opportunity. Because I would probably put myself in the exact same category as you, John. Technically, I was never the best. I was never the worst. Physically, you're saying you're 6'9", and being 4 foot nothing, you can imagine physically, I didn't really stand a chance. So it was only I suppose my ability, my desire to improve the mental side of my performance, which I think give me that opportunity to play for a long time. And I was really fortunate in one of the previous episodes to speak to Jay Fiedler, who was a quarterback for the Miami Dolphins, and just some of the things he talked about being in the NFL. I just wondered if you could maybe share a couple of things that, people who love the NBA like I do, it's so ironic being so small loving the NBA, but what were some of the things that you could share from that whole career you had that maybe people going in to work in an office, as a mother, whatever they want to do, as an amateur runner, whatever they want to do, what are some of the things that you could share with them that would help them in their lives?
Probably the biggest one I would say is playing in the league gives you a real understanding of recuperation because you play, if you're bad, 82 games a year, and if you're good, 100, 110, 100 more. And it gives you a really a good understanding of recuperation, not just crashing, right? And I think this is where, for people in work, this is a really important distinction. Many of us, even I've done this, where I finish my day at 8 o'clock and I'm like, essentially, it's grab something that I'm going to microwave. And then within half an hour, I'm in my bed and I'm out. And whilst that is sleep, what I've done there is n not no part of this is been really proactive recuperation. And recuperation to me, I learned in the league, was this idea of stuff that still costs you energy but delivers a dividend. So my day job, it costs me energy. I love the work. I mean, I was swore there, but I really love what I do. It's amazing, right? It's just amazing. It's amazing. Imagine having a job where what you do is you pay attention to people, you talk to them, and you, with your full intent and purpose, attempt to make whatever it is they want to get better, better. It's bloody brilliant. Anyway, but outside of that, your cup empties as you do this work. And so you have to actually do stuff that takes a bit of energy, but helps you recover. I remember training in the summertime in Arizona, 110 degree heat in America. And I remember being told we had a recovery day. And I was like, brilliant. And I'd already planned it in my head. I'm going to get up. Instead of getting up at 6 or 5, like I normally did, I'm going to get up at 11. And then I'm going to eat some food. And then I'm going to go back to bed. And then I'm going to eat some more food. And then I'm going to go back to bed. And that's going to be my recovery day. But that's crashing. And this guy, Warren Anderson, was my trainer in Arizona. He trained a lot of the NFL and NBA players in the summertime. And he said, no, we'll see you here. And I was like, well, if it's a recovery day, why am I coming to the gym and this big complex? And he had us in there doing yoga. This is back in the 90s, stretching in a pool, doing exercises in a pool, weight supported. And it was effortful. And obviously it was not sleeping and just lying around. But at the end of that day, I got home and I suddenly realized that I felt better. I felt younger. I felt my body didn't hurt as much. And that's the difference in sport, I think, is that in workplaces, we imagine that people should work 40 nowadays and we should be proud about it, right? How's your day? Oh, brilliant. I've been working since 5 o'clock in the morning. I won't finish until 9. So that's not the point. What are you doing to recuperate? I've already been for a walk this morning. I went for an hour and a half, went around Regent's Park. I just looked at the sun and the leaves and it was amazing. And that was my recuperation instead of lying in bed for an hour. That's the biggest thing, Paul. People have got to remember, there's this phrase, you can't pour from an empty cup and you can't fill that cup by crashing.
Do you think that that has been highlighted, especially in the last 18 months where, you know, people aren't going to the office anymore and probably potentially are working longer hours at home and without that distinction between work and home life balance?
People are definitely working longer hours than they used to. I would like to believe that it's going to be continually focused on, but I'm afraid that people, they've enjoyed the productivity boom that we've had through this pandemic. People have, the productivity has gone up. I just don't think people have recognized in the corporate space as well as they have in sports that sometimes giving people time to actively recharge through walking or running or yoga or whatever it is they do, whether it's at 12:30 in the day or whatever else time in the morning or night, that's the key to sustained productivity through disruption. I think people have paid attention to it while the pandemic was at its height, but there's this sense when you listen to leaders in business that it's kind of like, can't we just get back to the old ways? No, no is the answer. We shouldn't.
Today's podcast is sponsored by CSS Investments, a London-based regulated stockbroker that offers a bespoke advisory investment service for stocks and shares. I've personally used CSS for over 5 years now and happily recommend their services. You can find out more at css-investments.com. But please do remember that as with all investing, your capital is at risk. And John, whenever you're talking about this productivity boom, but it makes me think about the work that you do with organizations and how you've been coming out of the MBA and suddenly you're working in probably what most people would consider possibly the last kind of career you'd have after a sporting career. So how did you end up like that? Because we know you wanted to be a psychologist when you're 7, but did it really take you until you're, you know, 30, 35 before you truly did what you love?
No, I studied while I played. I was really fortunate. The NBA had a program that was designed to help athletes who left college, university early. They had this program that was designed to help you get your bachelor's degree so that you had some qualification. And I already had my bachelor's degree and had started my master's at Penn State, actually. And so I asked if I could use it for my graduate school. And they said, yeah, why not? So the program was half decent. It's a small school and so it's not kind of prestigious, but it gave me really great experiences. And the beauty was you could use it straight away. I started with a laptop that was about this thick, Toshiba laptop. And we would get on the plane, head off to wherever we're going from Orlando, especially. It was the time I was studying. going to, I don't know, Portland on the other side of the country. So you've got a 6-hour, 7-hour flight. And I would open the laptop and I would work through part of the night, get some naps in occasionally, get in very early in the morning often into Portland, and then have a nap. The amazing news was that as I studied and people knew I was studying psychology, I got less and less work done, because the moment I sat on this table alone to study, somebody would come and sit opposite me. And I remember this first happened very early in the season, actually, while we were still in preseason. We're flying off somewhere. And I sit down, I flip up my laptop, I start to type and work. And then one of my teammates, who I maybe have said 10 words to outside of kind of basketball words, sits opposite me. And I said, hello. And he said, "I." And he said, "So I've got a problem." And that was an amazing thing for me, because I realized that my teammates recognized, I mean, I don't know if they recognized experience or not, because I must have been terrible, but they recognized that I was at least someone who they could talk to. And so I spent that year getting my 10 points a game, but also being a kind of de facto in-house therapist before we had in-house therapists in basketball. So yeah, that's it just for me, it all fell together that the moment I retired, this is what I'll run into. And I think I took 6 months off. I retired in 2005, end of 2004, 2005, halfway through the season actually, and came to Manchester, drank a lot of red wine and ate a lot of cheesecake. And then 6 months later started APS.
So this is where I kind of, I suppose I'm not really fully joining the dots, because do you think that it was because you had a little bit of the kind of on-site training, what you wanted to do, and started to get the benefits, started to get almost the significance of working with people and starting to see the benefits of that? And is that what took you into the corporate world? Because there's such a massive difference between working in sport and working in the corporate world.
Yeah, I mean, I never wanted to be a sports psychologist. I know some great sports psychologists. I never wanted to work in sport. If I'm honest, and this will appear harsh, I'm not sure sports deserves my attention. It's so disappointing as an organized thing. Not kids playing sport, not older men like me playing sport, not people playing sport for fun, but the business of sport is so disappointing that I'm not sure it deserves my attention. And just think of that when you think of who we work with now. We work with big banks. We work with all kinds of people. And I see more willingness for change inside some petrochemical companies than I do inside the FA, for example.
But why do you think that is? Because, you know, the whole world of coaching essentially came from the world of sport, and the corporate world have kind of taken it and run with it, and probably, as you say, are much better of coaching and improving their people. But it also probably makes me jump back to the start of the conversation when you're talking about you don't really give a damn about sport. And so I'm just wondering where that comes from, because I have, you know, such a different point of view where I still have the love of football and what I do and being around it. So interesting how we both come through that sport and career and almost at the opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, I never loved sport. I reserve love for weightier things, I think. This doesn't mean I didn't have great experiences. I was talking the other day to a legend of basketball, who's a friend of mine and a colleague, a former colleague in the league. And I thought back to my time with them and this conversation that we had, and it was amazing. You may not know, but there's an app for old NBA players, so we can be connected. And so we can chat to each other at any time just by bringing up this app. And it's amazing to have those conversations. So I've got such fond memories of the individual people, such fond memories of even the administrators, David Stern back in the day, Adam now. So it's not that I hate the individuals or even hate anybody, but the world of sport is letting us down. It lies about who it says it is. It lies about the outcomes it can deliver. Sport doesn't magically make fat kids thin. It doesn't make poor kids wealthy. It doesn't make lazy kids active. Sport does exactly what we make it do. It's about the people. And sport right now, I mean, here we are with people kneeling and the coach has been very explicit, as have the players, that they're not kneeling for some activist movement. They're kneeling for equity for Black people in the world, for the safety of Black people in the world. And fans boo. And I'm not sure that I want to be a part of that.
Yeah, I fully understand what you mean there, because I used to think the same about the reputation that football fans used to have, and it was so poor, and it was almost as if like these people would go and use football as a vehicle for their aggression and for starting fights, and I never wanted to be associated with that. So I understand what you mean about this, but then this of course leads into, you know, such a worldwide issue, and especially around Black Lives Matter, which you have been such a leading voice over the last number of years. And I just wanted to tell you just a really quick story where a friend of mine's a Black girl from the Midlands in England. And I remember she put up a post recently and talking about, you know, just how tired she was. And I thought that, you know, I kind of felt like I'd had a little bit of that experience growing up as a Catholic in Ireland in the, you know, in the 80s and 90s. And when I tried to almost reach out there, say, I kind of think I know how you feel. And she just said, no, Paul, you don't. You really don't. And it was only when she explained the daily basis that she was getting this, and people of her, you know, her ethnicity were having the same issues. And then it really hit home for me that I actually, yeah, it was just back to that white privilege again.
And it's not that people don't have experiences of inequality, of oppression. And it's not that there's a hierarchy. So, you know, it's Black people, then it's Asians, then it's women, then it's, that's ridiculous. But, you know, I think as allies, whether it's straight people for the LGBTQ community, whether it's white people for Black, whether it's men for women, the thing we need to bear in mind is that the whole point of allyship is not quite ever experiencing the full harshness of the experience of the minority, but at the same time being willing to listen and learn, being willing to support, being willing to step up and stand up and speak out, and then amplify the voices of those other minorities. So, you know, I wouldn't be able to understand fully your experience, even though I've read books on it, even though I've seen documentaries on it. I can't imagine it. I just know that I would be very frightened indeed. I've seen those gates. I have seen some of the footage. I would be very frightened indeed. And so all I would need to know is not to compare your experiences to mine, but rather just to say, I'm really curious and interested in knowing about your experience and in having you tell me and help me to steer how I can best support. That's the job of all of us, I think, in this world. For those of us like you and me with power, with podcasts, with, you know, platforms, it's our job to speak out and amplify the voices of those who are less readily heard.
And I know you have a really strong statement about, and because I've heard you say it to me and others, when you talk about how it's just not enough to be non-racist, you actually need to be anti-racist. So can you maybe just give us a little bit of an understanding of what you mean by that? Because I think when you first said it, I wasn't 100% sure of what you meant.
Yeah, allyship is conflict. Right, that's the thing that people misunderstand. It's not rhetoric, it's conflict. It's not violence, but it is conflict. And so anti-racism and anti-misogyny and anti-Islamophobia or anti-Semitism or anti any incivility, any way that we undermine the dignity of people who are different than us, is a question of stating so clearly where you are. So this is what I tell people when people ask me. If racism is here, here is the fence, and I'm here. But I'm not just here kind of hoping that racism will dissipate on its own. I am here figuring out how to destroy this with fire. Misogyny, fence, me, destroying this with fire. Antisemitism, Islamophobia, homophobia, transphobia, you name it. Anything that undermines the dignity of somebody in my presence, fence, me, figuring out how to destroy this with fire. That's how proactive it is. For those of you who sit whilst friends tell that anti-Semitic joke they've been telling for the last decade and say nothing, and then tell other people how you disapprove. Oh yeah, I don't really like that. But you say nothing in the moment. That's not anti-Semitic. That's just nothing. It's an abdication of our responsibility. Instead, we have to be anti-Semitic. We actually have to speak up in the moment and say, look, John, I'm sorry, not that joke again. Come on. It's 2021, not that joke again. Not that sexist joke again. If you can only be funny by undermining someone else, that's a problem. And if anybody thinks that I'm being politically correct, great. Great. I'm that guy. You come into my area of control, I'm that guy. On Zoom, on Teams, whatever it is, I'm the guy. You say something uncivil to somebody else, doesn't need to be about someone who's gay or black or male. You say something uncivil about anybody, I'm the guy who'll tell you that I hear it, I see it, and it's not acceptable. And that's what being anti-racist or anti-sexist or anti-homophobic, that's what it's about. Action and conflict.
And I think you touched on the point a little bit earlier, John, when you talked about how, you know, maybe someone like you or I, who people might know a little bit more, or they might hear our voices a little bit more than others. And I think some people might think, but, you know, if I'm the normal, you know, Joe Bloggs who's going to work, going about their business, you know, I have such a small sphere of influence. So it's a bit like, you know, why should I even try?
But you just said it there. You just said that they have a sphere of influence. That's all I'm asking. I'm not asking for an individual person who's got three mates who kind of respect them and maybe a couple of family members. I'm not asking them to start a blog to change the world. Though I would point out that there's a small Scandinavian child who's done that. What I'm saying is just make sure that with those three mates and that family group, that they know where you stand. People forget that there's an amazing power to telling people where you stand on stuff. When you tell people where you stand and what you stand for, it allows them to understand what you won't stand for, what you will not tolerate. And that's incredibly powerful. The peer pressure, the social pressure of that is powerful. It means that when somebody sees you in a group, maybe they don't tell that joke. And if you don't think that's important, you're missing the point, because people's experience is defined by what they hear said and what they see done, not by what people think. By what people say and do. And if you can be the person amongst even five people or two people or one person that changes their behavior around people who are different, you have done a service to this world.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
And John, I think we've covered so many different areas and you know, parts of your career. And I suppose I wanted to keep the last bit for your first book, Man in the Middle, but also about The Promises of Giants, your new book. So can you give us an understanding of essentially more about the new book, The Promises of Giants? Because I think it's okay if you're 6'9", you could probably fit into that category. But as a little short 4'0" Irish guy, possibly don't necessarily fit into the giant category.
Paul, everybody is a giant to somebody. Everybody is a giant to somebody. And everybody has the potential to have an influence over somebody, a really positive impact on a group of people. I wrote this book because there is a paucity of leadership out there. There is an abject, I mean, it doesn't matter what your party political affiliation is, there or what country you're in. There is an absence of principled, ethical, driven, and ambitious leadership. This is not about named leadership. This is a book. It has three parts, essentially. The first part is about introspection, because I think that the way you make progress is by knowing where you are. Who are you? What are your challenges? What are your upsides? What is your potential? What do you stand for? Who do you want to be? And then there's interpersonal. How do you interact with other people? Those who are similar to you, those who are different. How do you influence? How do you negotiate? How do you create experiences for people that are positive and that make a difference? And then there's organizations. It doesn't matter really whether you're in business or in a community or in sports. There's always an organization to navigate, one to influence, one to operate inside. There's politics, there's all kinds of stuff. But how can you do that? So the book is 14 promises split into those three areas: introspection, interpersonal, organizational. because I want to help people find their giant. I want people, no matter how physically tall they are, to realize that there is a giant in all of us, you know, that there's an ability for all of us to make a difference in this world. And I know that the world is full of people telling you that's not the case, because it's convenient if you feel small, if you feel like your impact is meaningless, that what you do is meaningless. Look what's happening with voting around the world. Not only have we've moved from telling people that their vote doesn't matter to now telling people that they can't vote because it doesn't matter. We need giants in this world so badly. And I want to help people find theirs.
And is that in the sense of trying to help someone be the best they can be in terms of, you know, fulfilling their potential? Or is that to try and show people that there's a process that you can follow? And if you follow somewhere along these lines, similar to what you did when you were playing in the NBA, if you can do these things, then you have a much greater opportunity or chance of reaching your potential.
Yeah, there's certainly lots of those lessons from my life in this book. You know, some of the anecdotes that I've talked about, I've got more detail around them. But there's also bits that you can actually work on. There's workbook elements of it, so you can actually drive some of that yourself. It isn't prescriptive. It isn't about saying this is the kind of leader you must be. It's that, how do you figure out what kind of leader you can be and in what context? This is not about named leadership or titles. This is about your impact on the world, or the part of the world that you want to impact, or the person you want to impact, which might just be you. What have you been trying to achieve for the last 3 years and it's failed, or you've had to restart, or what is it you want to do? Figure out that plan, figure out the implications of it. What needs to be true to get to where you want to go? And how do you build that plan? So yes, it's definitely about individual achievement. I want people to do brilliant things for themselves. And I want people to realize that as they become masters of what they do brilliantly, they have a responsibility to impact the world positively.
That, and see, that's something that I really struggled with whenever I was either playing football or even the last 10, 11 years of having the role that I have of speaking with organizations. And it very much seemed about me being the best that I could be and pushing myself and trying to reach my potential. But while I was doing that, John, there were a lot of things that kind of got lost along the way. And, you know, people get pushed to the side, relationships. And that's really difficult, I think, what you're asking people to do.
Yeah, that doesn't have to be all the sacrifices we think. You know, every day on LinkedIn or Twitter, I'll see some list of these are the five things you need to do as a leader. And it always starts with some nonsense about getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and then doing CrossFit or some bollocks. And it's like, that's not what it is. Yes, you need to recuperate. Yes, you need your physical health. Yes, you need your wellness. Yes, you need balance. Yes, relationships are important. And yes, you are going to dive into more effortful, focused work than you can imagine in order to be successful. But none of this has to come at the expense of the other. It's not have a family or do this. Although I know for women, we make that incredibly difficult at the moment, but it doesn't have to be that way. It's not be successful and burn yourself to a crisp. You can be successful and not die because you've kind of abdicated your responsibility to take care of your body. There's a lot of myths out there. And I think the book is trying to help people embrace the promises that will make a difference. The first promise is about viewing yourself critically, but not cruelly. That's the first promise in the book. The idea that where most people fail is that they have an inner voice that tells them how terrible and ugly and bad and pointless their lives are. A voice that can't acknowledge the brilliance that they have, or maybe sometimes acknowledge the challenges that they face as a person and some of their personality quirks and traits that aren't so helpful, like me being abjectly lazy. But this is just the first of many of the promises. And what it also tries to do is get rid of some of the nonsense promises, the things that aren't real about leadership. The idea that to be a leader, you have to be loud and you have to be bossy and you have to be not really assertive, but you know, almost cruel and horrible. You don't have to be successful. That's what I hope the book will give people. A bit of a roadmap, a chance to truly reflect on who they are, what they want to achieve, and the impact they want to have on the world around them. It's the thing about being an actual giant, Paul. I'm an actual giant. And every day when I am around people who are usually much smaller than me, I consider every move that I make, because I know that if I am not careful, a thoughtless move by me might hurt somebody. There's a new mindset that comes when you realize you're a giant. Each thing that you do is disproportionately powerful.
That's so powerful, the way you say that, John. And I think when you're talking about that voice in your head, you know, I think you talk about imposter syndrome and how probably we all have it at different stages in our life, but also how it's so rife and so plentiful across the world that is it not just something that's inbuilt within our psyche that we are constantly playing ourselves down? So that almost seems very difficult to go against.
The thing I would say about imposter syndrome is this, is I know it's everywhere, and I know most people suffer from it at one time or another. I just need to point out that one of the conclusions we could come to is that everybody is a little bit broken. Everyone's a little bit broken, and that's why. Or, and I think more properly, I heard a researcher, she was a brilliant woman. I walked into the end of her lecture about 3 years ago at a conference. I forget where. But I remember her saying, she was talking about imposter syndrome. She said, never forget, imposter syndrome is not a personal pathology. It's how you're supposed to feel. It's how the world, the structures that currently exist, want you to feel. If you do not fit the mold of a particular organization, if you're in the arts, for example, in theater, and you don't fit the mold of a theater person, if you're in accountancy and you don't fit the mold of an accountant, if you're in any kind of business or sport and you don't fit the mold, then you're supposed to feel imposter syndrome. It's unfortunate that we've built our systems so that they make contributors, people who would otherwise want to fulsomely and be able to fulsomely contribute, question themselves. But what we can do is train the voice in our head so that that voice in our head doesn't run wild telling us how terrible and awful and ugly we are. And instead, we can challenge it, because most people's voice in their head talks to them in a way that we would never tolerate a stranger talking to us. We would never tolerate a friend talking to us that way. And in fact, if a friend did talk that way, we'd know they weren't our friend. And so we can challenge that. And that's another one of the things that happens in the book. How do you challenge that voice in your head?
Yeah, that's fantastic. And if I start reflecting on, John, some of the things that you've done in your career, your remarkable career, at least up to this point already, I suppose one of the questions that really is on the tip of my tongue that I want to ask you is, considering, you know, you've had that opportunity to play in the NBA, you've done what you've always wanted to do in terms of becoming, you know, a psychologist and working with the organizations that you do, and even just hearing the passion, the way you talk about it, how you love doing it, and there's no better job. Has there been a price to your success?
No, there have been choices that I've made and continue to make because there are areas of my life I'm less adept. But not prices. No, I mean, if you're talking about discomfort, then yeah, there's been a price. My life has been most uncomfortable. Again, one of the promises, I promise to reject excuses and embrace discomfort. That's one of the promises of giants. But that's the price I've paid. I have spent much of my life in discomfort, outside of my comfort zone, either in a sporting context or surrounded by people who are cleverer than me in a psychological or other context. That is the price you pay. Stretch constantly. Have I been in pain that whole time? No. But discomfort? Yes. Yeah. But you don't have to lose to win. You just have to endure some discomfort.
And does that not go against, is it Maslow's hierarchy of needs of how we want comfort? And it sounds like you're almost seeking out discomfort on a long-term basis.
So I could have a long conversation with you about the number of people who have superseded Maslow. And there's a huge number. I know people love Maslow because it's a triangle and it's nice and easy. And we know, right, that's been superseded by, just like when you look at emotional literacy, the original Goleman research has been superseded now by people with the four-branch model or something else. I lose track. But I'm not suggesting that you never have comfort. I'm saying that in order to reach the next plateau where you can stand and survey your success, to get to that point will be leg-burning discomfort. Your lungs will burn, your legs will burn, and then you'll reach a point where you can look and say, right, this is pretty good. Am I satisfied with this view? Is this enough? Am I a big enough giant now? Is the amount of responsibility and accountability that comes with this size all I want? If the answer is yes, then for many people, you can continue to live in an area of mastery, even if it's not your potential. I would encourage people to imagine maybe another climb, and maybe I lift some people while I climb. Maybe a bit of burning in the legs and lungs is worth it. I've found it so. I have a job where my presence and carefully thought out words can make people feel as if they can cope again. I can't imagine what level of discomfort wouldn't be worth that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it leads me on to, I think, what would be the last question for you, John, because, you know, I started off with asking what is the definition of success? And you talked about being personal and meaningful and purposeful. And for you now, at your stage in life, going forward, what would you say is your definition of success?
For me, there is so much more I want to learn. So I don't learn as much as I used to. And it's not because of age, though that is a factor. I don't learn as much as I used to because my days are too busy. So one of my goals busy is the wrong word. My days are too packed with meaningful activity. So that's not busyness. That's not the same thing. But they're too packed with meaningful stuff. And so we're moving and my team is growing. And so I'm going to do less and less and think more and more and learn more and more. And that's going to be success for me. I want to work with powerful people who have the ability to influence the world. And I want them to hear a different message about leadership than perhaps they've heard before. I want to enable burgeoning young, new leaders in lots of different contexts, education, community, as well as business. Philanthropy, especially, there's an area that needs radical overhaul. I want to work with the kind of people who will be the future. I'm not a person of faith. My mother is alive today because I have told stories that other people will tell other people. And she will live forever, for as long as people tell her story. My job is to make it so that people will tell the stories that I tell after I'm gone.
Well, John Amici, thank you so much for your time. I really, really enjoyed that.
Thank you so much. A pleasure.
Well, I have just been blown away by listening to John Amici for the last 60 minutes and hearing some of the wonderful insights and expertise that he has just shared with me and everyone listening, because I think he summed it up best at the end when he talked about the introspection, the interpersonal relationships, and the organizations or communities that we find ourselves in, and how we can all become giants, even if you're 4 foot nothing like me. I really hope you enjoyed that, and I hope you can join us for another episode of The Psychology of Success. And a final thank you for everyone involved in making today's show. From producing it, we've got Moment Digital with Neil Stainsby and Peter Wright. Hayley Brasnett is the editor. Dave Webster has been our researcher. And Emily Drake helps get us out all of our social media posts on the psychology of success.